My government made a promise to me that it kept. That gets a much bigger laugh in a conservative group, by the way. This is how you tell who you're talking to. They said when I went into the Peace Corps that I would always, however I felt about my experience, whether it was good or bad, that would always be my country, and that I would read every article, and that's been really easy to do for me because nobody ever talked about Tunisia for the last 40 years until 2 weeks ago. And now keeping up with my Tunisia is an almost full-time occupation. And I'll get to that in the second part of the sermon. But what really called upon me was what was going on in Tunisia, along with the death of Sergeant Shriver, the founding director of the Peace Corps, and what a life of service he led. And all of our readings and songs have been talking about service, and service is our prayer. The Peace Corps was a remarkable idea. When John F. Kennedy said, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country, it was something that many of my generation took very personally. And it wasn't, and I will tell you this from the depth of my soul, it wasn't a neo-colonialism of, well, we white Americans really are going to go all over Latin America and Africa and Asia and save these people. It was hands touching hands. It was making the abstract and the other real and personal. When I applied to go into the Peace Corps in 1966, the Vietnam War was raging, and we were assigned to Tunisia, an Arab country, and we arrived shortly after the Six-Day War. It was not immediately self-evident that I had chosen the safer venue, particularly after the first day at my lycée, when Hannah came up to me and said, hello, I'm Jewish. And I then had the moral question of, do I say how nice for you, or do I say me too? And so everybody in my village knew I was Jewish. And that was part of the experience of other to other that was no longer an other. It was a we. It was an us. It was people across religious and political and ethnic and color spectrum, living together, working together, getting to know each other, not as labels. Oh, the American. Oh, those dumb Americans. We only heard those dumb Americans from the French, who were also serving as volunteers on their service coopérant. But from the host country nationals, there was this incredible sense of connection, of affinity. We worked together. We socialized together. I made my social faux pas, and I was forgiven for my I'm left-handed, and eating with your left hand is not something that you do in that society. And eating with my right hand got an awful lot of couscous in my ear. I made an awful lot of mistakes, as Americans did, but the lasting gift was not the information. It wasn't the technical part. It was the human part. It was people being together and growing together and sharing together. So that's the easy, and I guess this connects a little bit with the sermon title, I could have rationalized it, that the easy labels and libels of, oh, it's an American, it's a Jew, or from my side, oh, Arabs. What can you expect from Arabs? What can you expect from Muslims? You expect and you experience humanity. That the labels and the libels get replaced by experience, by kindness, by wisdom, by meals that are shared, by tasks that are shared. One of the most important moments that we had was that first Thanksgiving, when American Thanksgiving as a holiday had never been more important to me than it was far away from home. And the Peace Corps volunteers went out and found the scrawniest turkeys. Turkeys are not really a major source of food there. And we raised these turkeys, and then we had to do it and then pluck it. And nobody had an oven that could handle it, so we had to take it to the bread baker. And we baked the turkeys at the bakery, and we served them with artichokes, not your standard accompaniment, invited our colleagues and friends from all nationalities and spoke about Thanksgiving and what we were grateful for. And so you had Jews and Christians and Muslims and hardcore Marxists, those were the French again, usually very wealthy hardcore Marxists, there's some ironies there, that were all together at this feast and celebration. We were not stereotypes to each other. We were people with strengths and with weaknesses. I studied Islam with the Imam of Nabul. Now, I know that that sounds like something out of Kismet, but the Imam of Nabul was a wise and learned man. And when you do the stereotypes about, well, an Imam must be a religious fundamentalist and must be narrow and intolerant, well, then you would be wrong. Because his wife was one of the leaders in women's liberation and empowerment of women and had created within their own home a school for girls, a preschool really for girls, because there was universal education under Bourguiba. It was remarkable. I met remarkable people. The Imam of Nabul, Si Salem Amouri, was just a remarkable, open, and inquisitive person who had, before he had gone blind, read all of the great works of philosophers and of playwrights and had a wonderful mind and a wonderful heart. So when I hear these labels that people use, well, he's a Muslim, he's a fundamentalist, he's an imam, those labels have human faces and hearts and souls because of the experience of being together, of teaching each other, not didactically, not so much about facts, but understanding that his religiosity was something that, like ours, was practiced. It wasn't simply about what he believed or what he recited. What he recited was often, to use words that I would learn later in Berkeley, were mantras that let him contemplate and experience a kind of meditation. Because when you do the same prayers, I'm not talking about just our affirmation, but any prayers repetitively over a period of time, you're not going to hear the literal words. You'll let the music sing to you and act as a background to let your heart, your soul, drift elsewhere. Another remarkable man I met was another Salah Jamali, who was my camel guide on a safari across too large a section, as it turned out, of the Sahara for me. And riding a camel across the Sahara could put you in a bad warlike mood, I found out. It's not the most pleasant experience in the world, but our interaction was, and I know I've told this story before, but it's worth telling. I remember our failure to communicate, and this is how important words and patience are. I said to Sisala, I asked him, I said, so, what's my camel's name? I wanted to know exactly whom I should be cursing, because my camel, as some of you know from my first book, felt like it only had three legs. I mean, it was just ga-gunk, ga-gunk, ga-gunk. And he looked at me with that look of incredulity and pity that I often get from my wife, which is, what are you talking about? I said, the camel's name. The camel's name is Camel. I said, I know that. That's why I used the word camel in Arabic, you know. And he said, no, his name's Camel. I said, well, my name is John. Your name is Salah. what's the camel's name? And then he got it. He said, we don't give human names to animals. All of the human names we have are in the Quran and are holy. So we just don't do that. It was a cultural difference. It was a cultural difference. Another experience with him, we were camping. It's one of the reasons I don't camp. And a Bedouin tent in the desert. And I got up in the morning. There were all these nice little squiggles in the sand, like somebody had raked the sand trap really nicely. And I looked at him and I said, Shnua, what's that? And he said, oh, those were the asps, the snakes. And I said, all around the tent and all around the mattresses, well, not mattresses, but the straw pads we were sleeping on. He said, yeah. I said, why didn't you tell me? He said, it could have been my grandmother. What would it have helped? You'd have only worried. You'd have lost sleep. It wouldn't have kept the snakes away. I mean, I completely got that. And yeah, and he said, and this was another piece of wisdom. He said, well, you know, you'd spend the time worrying about snakes, but snakes almost never bite sleeping people. What you should have worried about are the camels. Why should I worry about the camels? Well, they have really long memories, and they're often mistreated. And when they are, they sometimes get up in the middle of the night and stomp to death their... I'm going, so I guess I won't lose sleep tonight over the snakes. I'll just worry about the camels. Said, you know, you guys always worry about the wrong thing. And I thought those were real words of wisdom. Then I asked him, and as our conversation went on, it got more and more kind of philosophical. And so I asked him about the meaning of life. And again, he gave me that look like, what are you talking about? The meaning of life is I get up, I've got some deserts to cross, I've got an oasis to find, and if I don't find it, GPSs had not been invented at that point, then my parched bones are in the middle of the desert. So the purpose of life is to get from one oasis to the other and try to avoid leaving your bones, you know, because it messes up the desert. And the question of what is the meaning of life is in many ways a luxury question that people with leisure get to ask as an abstraction as opposed to being fully engaged every day. He talked about religion and his religion. I asked him when he prayed, and he prayed five times a day, sometimes combining two services into one, but did the ablutions with the sand and then prayed towards Mecca. And I asked him if he paid attention to all those prayers because they were the same prayers. And as I indicated, he said, sometimes I'm hearing the words and sometimes it's background just and my thoughts go off into the infinite. And I asked him about other religions because as a Tunisian, he understood that there were Catholics because there had been Italians there first and then French, and he knew the Jewish community in Djerba, and he knew about a lot of the religions. And I said, so what makes one different from another? And he said, well, I'm what I am, but the religions are like the fingers of my hand. They all serve the same master. And I said, yes, they all serve you. And then he looked at me and gave me that look again and said, no, they all serve God. But he understood that we were all engaged in a common pursuit of finding a way to be mindful of the miracle of life and of the choices that we have and of the joys and the pleasures and the challenges that we have. Can I ever stereotype a whole people, a whole religion, after these kinds of nourishing experiences? And my favorite nourishing experience in retrospect is when I was sick on this caravan and I had gotten what the Peace Corps volunteers called the Mack truck disease. You felt you'd been run over by a Mack truck. And when I was out of it, I saw him writing in a bowl and he fed me, and I asked him when I came back to myself what that was about. He said, you were too weak to pray. So I wrote a prayer in the bowl, dissolved it, and you drank up the prayer in God's words and took it in as physical and spiritual nourishment. Now, do I have to believe in the magical explanation, or do I have the option of connecting with the humanity, with the generosity of spirit? Is this the time to engage in the, well, I don't really believe in the efficacy of petitionary prayer, and certainly a prayer that I've taken in while I'm not conscious doesn't really... It was about his heart and his generosity. This makes it, again, hard to label and libel other people. What America got for the Peace Corps were relationships, not information necessarily conveyed, not even water plants planted, not even mosques built as our architects did, but working together and being together in a community that was not based on simply accidents of birth. But our accidents of different births and traditions made us all better and wiser. So when I was watching what was going on in Tunisia over the last 2 weeks, I felt I had a stake in it. I mean, it is in some ways my country. I was watching World Cup qualifying match some years ago up at the university where I teach, American Jewish University, and I'm screaming at the television at these Arabs, and I'm screaming for them, and that got some notice in the faculty lounge, and it's my country, and I care about what happens to it. And I read everything, and the characters, the people who are involved in this remarkable opportunity to change their society and to change it without wholesale killing. It's a remarkable opportunity. Whether it's realized or not is still up in the air, because human beings being human beings, sometimes the perfect gets in the way of the possible. And if they purge everybody that had any connection with the bad political party, which was the only one there, they'll purge all of the continuity and all of the competency. America, after World War II, was pretty smart about trying to distinguish redeemable members of the Nazi Party and irredeemable members of the Nazi Party. America was pretty not smart in Iraq, well, going, but also getting rid of everybody who had any power and had any experience, and with the de-bathification, and so there's no continuity and no competency, and a whole other group came in. The Tunisians are rightly angry at their government. They stood up against it in what was really a non-lethal revolution. They won not by killing, but by being willing to die. This came out in last week's talkback. And it was a very important point to make. And I started thinking about what would have happened in the civil rights movement in the late 50s and early 60s if the civil rights movement had been armed then as Americans are armed now. What would have happened if the bullets had started flying in two directions? And I don't think, as imperfect as the now is, I don't think we'd be anywhere close to where we are. It was the dignity of people in the civil rights movement who would bear the taunts and the beatings and the death and the violence, and it was the distorted faces of hatred and of violence that opened up the American heart. The nonviolence really worked, and the nonviolence has a chance of working in North Africa and being an example, a beacon, a light to other nations, not simply across North Africa or in the Arab world, but everywhere where there is oppression and a kleptocracy and the people in the name of stability are kept from being free. There are tremendous messages of hope. And I think that all of us are called upon, as Sergeant Shriver, in responding to Kennedy's request, did in both that and anti-poverty programs, to be involved in service. To be involved in service at every level. When you go to the homeless shelter and work, it makes it harder just to put a label on the them out there who have lost their homes, because those thems are us, and all too many are two paychecks away from taking a bivouac in a car. It's a tender world we live in, and there, but for the grace of whatever you believe in, we could be in those situations. And you get to see the humanity of the other. When people talk about what is going on and the terrible things in terrible neighborhoods and lump terrible people together and all of this, have some experience with the other, because service is our prayer. Jacques Ellul, the great Christian theologian, talked about the most important form of prayer being self-involving prayer. It isn't asking, oh God, please create enough food for the world. We've got enough calories. Who's up to the distribution? Who's up to the distribution of wealth, of food, of education, of water, of dignity? This is how we are called forth to pray by our actions, to pray with commitment, to be part of a partnership with however we understand the divine operating, whether as passively as existence or actively in existence. The theology isn't important. What is important is the experience of being with people and understanding the common humanity that we share. Because when we see it in that person whom we thought to be the other, even the adversary, we change our lives, we nourish our souls, and we get the energy to carry that gift that we have gotten from that interaction, what Martin Buber called the I-thou relationship, to really see the thou, the intimacy in the other person. We carry that on to the next interaction. And it helps us through rough relationships and rough times, because there are moments when you are disappointed. There are societies that will disappoint you. There are people against whom you need to push back, and political movements against which we need to sometimes push back, but never forgetting that they are not the totally other, that they are not some label, and not restricting them with a label, but seeing the humanity in the person who is close to us and seemingly far away. Service is our prayer. And the gift that the Peace Corps gave to me, that it gave to so many Americans, aside from the fact that when I got to seminary, the first thing we did was had a soccer match between the returned Peace Corps volunteers and the civilians, and we killed them. But we're not supposed to use that metaphor. We killed them figuratively. But what the Peace Corps begat were people dedicated disproportionately to service, to finding the humanity in the other, to engaging the other, not the xenophobia of shrinking away, but the philia of being drawn towards finding out what makes another person tick, what nourishes her soul, what makes their eyes light up, and how we each can be a part of making those eyes light up. That is our service. That is our prayer. That is our calling.